Dunkin' has a whole new line of handcrafted signature lattes. Blueberry Crisp, Caramel Craze, and Cocoa Mocha. They're so delicious, you'll realize that you've been spending a whole latte time drinking the wrong coffee. So even though you've been together for years, it's time to say goodbye to your ex. Coffee Place. Because you've got a latte love for Dunkin' signature lattes. Sipping is believing with Dunkin's new handcrafted signature lattes, like Blueberry Crisp, Caramel Craze, or Cocoa Mocha. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Source Material Comics Podcast. We're coming back at you. Episode, as we have just discussed, 239, that's right. Just on the edge of 240, and that was me in high school. I was just on the edge of 240. Oh my goodness, this is going to be an adventure. We are about to start. This is the very beginning of Onslaught Month. That's right. September, right here on the Rattlitch Inn Broadcasting Network, is Onslaught Month. We are taking a look at four trade paperbacks straight from the 1990s, involving the mega crossover, the one that rocked the Marvel Universe to its core. That's right. Onslaught invaded the Marvel Universe and just turned everything upside down. And we're going to tell you all about it here. Tonight, my partners in crime here, Mark Rattlitch, the patriarch of the Rattlitch and Broadcasting Network. My friend, are you ready to discuss Onslaught?
I am, Jesse. I'm excited about this. We've had this on the calendar for a year since you were like, we need to dedicate an entire month to Onslaught. And I'm like, what's an Onslaught?
Yeah, no idea, did you?
Not a clue.
No clue. Well, we're not alone here. He is my friend from the Unspoken Issues podcast, our good buddy contributor to the Unspoken Decade, and my fellow 90s comics enthusiast. His name is Chris Armstrong. Chris Armstrong, Onslaught approaches, sir. Are you ready to discuss?
Alex, Kurt, Sean, Cable, anyone?
Get used to reading that several times if you want to read this comic.
Let's pop up a little bit. And we have a fourth person right here on this panel tonight. If he's not a fan of 90s comics, I know for sure he's a fan of one Squirrel Girl. His name is Evan Bevins. Evan Bevins, Onslaught is here, sir. Are you ready to talk about it?
Well, I gotta be honest, I thought we were talking about the team from Kurok that was hired to assassinate the president and fought the Suicide Squad, but I read some Marvel Onslaught, too.
I'm glad you're here, sir. All right, well, I'm excited, man. This is something that happened in my comic book collecting days. This is something that really piqued my interest. This crossover, I should say, Mega Marvel crossover, started in June of 1996. According to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, the on-sale date of X-Men 53, which was the first appearance of Onslaught, occurred on April 16th of 1996. That's when it dropped on the shelves. There was quite the road. As a matter of fact, we made a few jokes here, Mark Rattlitch, that the road to Onslaught was a million miles long.
Yes.
And you made it through two-thirds of those million miles. You had time on your hands, and you picked up the Road to Onslaught books, read through a few of those. Can you kind of give us an idea? I mean, this is a character that a lot of us, at least I know we read, three of us have read. Mark, you said you didn't have any idea who this was, but you read the Road to Onslaught. Can you give us just a quick idea or rundown of what you read?
Yeah, Cannonball's from Kentucky. Thanks.
That is.
So sad, yeah, there's a lot about Cannonball in the Road to Onslaught and his sort of dealing with the fact that he's like a probationary permanent X-Men. And there's a lot of talk about him having to train and, you know, the seriousness it takes. This does have a payoff once we get to Onslaught proper, as all of this self-doubt leads him to confronting Xavier, and Xavier tells him basically to fuck right off, which leads some of the X-Men to believe maybe Xavier is not in the right state of mind. And of course he isn't, because Onslaught. There's also a bit about Sabretooth and I guess Wolverine. Some of the stuff that they reference is not in the Road to Onslaught, but I'm going to do my best to kind of talk through this without confusing you, me, and everybody else listening to this.
Okay.
But apparently, prior to the Road to Onslaught proper, Wolverine stabbed Sabretooth in the noodle, and so he ended up becoming like a prisoner of the X-Men, and Xavier was trying to cure him of his homicidal rages, which turns out I think he was playing possum for a while and he inevitably does escape. And then I think he tries to like murder by cop himself with the X-Men.
Oh, wow.
And, at some point. And this is important because the whole evolution of Xavier to Onslaught starts with actually a book that you guys did earlier in the year, Jesse. Mm-hmm. The bit where Xavier mind wipes Magneto.
Yeah, this is Fatal Attractions, right, Chris?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Apparently that is the beginning of the end for Xavier and his...
Is that issue included in the Road to Onslaught collection?
It is not, but it is referenced at least every other page. So Xavier mind wipes Magneto, and it kind of gets the ball rolling to where he gets to pretty much losing his patience with humanity and becoming this other being. They talk about Onslaught being like part Xavier, part Magneto, and the reason why that is the case is the result of the mind wipe. So you have that, you have the failure to cure Sabretooth of his homicidal rages, you have the legacy virus. I don't know if this was covered in anything you guys did earlier in the year, but the legacy virus, one, is an issue for mutants in general, but also like causes the humans. It's kind of the AIDS of the comic book thing, where people are reacting to it like it's going to kill everybody. There's a lot of misinformation out there. Again, it's a parallel to the way AIDS was looked at in the 80s, where it was, quote unquote, the gay disease. Straight people didn't think they could get it. There was a lot of misinformation out there. Same thing with the legacy virus. This is yet another thing that kind of causes Xavier to start to go off the deep end. Prior to all this starting, Rogue kissed Gambit and he went into a coma like you do.
Oh, my.
And then she went on the road with Iceman for a while.
Okay.
And just like gave up being an X-Man. She ends
Sugar.
Up... Sugar.
She is from the South, much like Cannonball.
Oh, yes.
I don't know if anyone knows that. And just to wrap this up, she ends up going on the road with Iceman. Eventually, Gambit goes after her, and Gambit has like the secret that she's now aware of, having kissed him, and she's like, I need you to talk to me about this, and he's like, no, and it's all very dramatic, very soap opera-ish. He ends up going back to the X-Men. She stays away, but she finds Magneto at some point. Magneto starts to regain some sense of who he is. He's
talking about Joseph.
Yeah, he's now referring to himself as Joseph. I forget why. This is what happens when you read the stuff out of order. But she goes on the road with him for a while. And the last thing, and that kind of bleeds from the Road to Onslaught proper, is Bishop knows one of the X-Men will betray the team.
Yeah, this has been around since Bishop showed up, right? I mean, that was the whole reason he came back, because there was going to be an X-traitor.
And if it's not Gambit, then he's a monkey's uncle.
Yes, sir.
Spoiler alert. It's not.
Yeah. But you can't tell Bishop that through most of this. And so at one point, Bishop and Gambit form kind of like a buddy cop duo, where it's just like, I don't like you, and I don't like you either, Kayshawn, you know? But they like pal around together, and it's like, oh, you might be traitor to the X. I don't know why Bishop's the one with the Cajun accent. But it's like, hey, you might
he has
you
to listen to Gambit all the fucking time.
And Gambit's like, are you mocking me?
Got Cajun by osmosis. He's like, yeah, you might betray the X-Men, but you're an okay guy, so as long as you don't, you're okay by me. He's like, oh, Cajun, I will never betray the X-Men, mon ami.
I'm in danger of tossing out some Incredible Hulk Returns quotes if we don't jump off this Cajun thing.
Okay.
Hey, you're just as Cajun as me, man.
I believe... Sorry. I believe that's kind of it. Does that help you guys kind of get to, you know, all the stuff that... The Road to Onslaught is basically all the shit that happened that weighs on Xavier and makes him snap and turn into Onslaught.
Okay. All right. Now, did you even talk about the Juggernaut and, like, what happened with him? Or did I miss that?
I didn't. I guess that's important. It's actually on the cover of the first volume of the Road to Onslaught, where basically he gets attacked. I don't remember if they actually showed it or not, but he just kind of like shows up and he's just planted on the ground, and all he'll say is Onslaught. At some point, him and Jean Grey have kind of like a little side adventure by themselves. Like, he goes to her for help and he's like, yeah, I haven't murdered every single one of your teammates because I actually need you to help me. I know of Onslaught. I know he's coming, but I don't know why or why I'm even saying that. I need help. I need you to get inside my noodle. And
I was going
to
say that happens in our first volume here.
Yeah.
All right. Real quick, we're going to break for a synopsis of the complete Onslaught Epic Trade Paperback Volume 1. Now, this synopsis is going to last about 8 minutes. So if you want to fast forward because you've already read these, feel free to do so to join the discussion immediately after. Here we go. X-Men number 53, False Fronts. Writer Mark Waid, art by Andy Kubert and Cam Smith. Jean Grey of the X-Men is confronted by an unknown powerful psionic being on the astral plane. Trying to learn his name, the being attempts to turn her against humanity. He shows Jean the hypocritical minds of humans and how they mistrust mutants, but even going further to show the deepest secrets of her own mentor, Xavier himself. The being also tries in vain to get her to embrace the power of the Phoenix and join him. While she resists and battles him on the astral plane, the fight abruptly ends when he defeats her, sending her back to reality with the name Onslaught written on her forehead. Elsewhere, Psylocke and Angel are surprised by the Juggernaut, who appears seemingly out of nowhere, needing to get to the X-Men to tell them something big. Other side notes, we learn that recently Beast was replaced by his Age of Apocalypse doppelganger, who will be known as Dark Beast. Uncanny X-Men 334, Dark Horizon. Writer Scott Lobdell, art by Joe Madureira and Tim Townsend. Juggernaut has made his way to the Xavier Institute for Higher Learning in order to find the team to tell them of the coming of Onslaught. Inside, Bishop and Gambit, once mistrusting teammates, are starting to tolerate each other's company, while Jean tells Scott of Onslaught but wants to wait to tell the professor, who is in his study, uncharacteristically admonishing Cannonball, who came to him for guidance. Gambit and Bishop confront Juggernaut, who trips one of the mansion's alarms, and Juggernaut makes short work of them. When Jean Grey finds Juggernaut, he asks that she read his mind, but they must do so in a psi-shielded facility underground, so that they may be undetected in doing so. X-Men number 54, Inquiring Minds. Writer Mark Waid, art by Andy Kubert and Dan Panosian. Bishop and Gambit warn the rest of the X-Men that Juggernaut is here, and they are on the hunt. Meanwhile, Jean attempts to read the mind of the Juggernaut, but realizes the door to the psi-shielded bunker was left open. Xavier is enraged by a news report of a hate crime against another mutant. At that exact moment, Jean and Juggernaut learn the true identity of Onslaught, and both immediately head back to the mansion. As Juggernaut is the first to get there, while Jean gathers the X-Men, Juggernaut finds Charles Xavier has already become the being known as Onslaught, who proceeds to rip the Crimson Gem of Sidorak, the thing that gives Juggernaut his power, out of his chest. Onslaught, X-Men number 1, Traitor to the Cause. Writer Scott Lobdell and Mark Waid, art by Adam Kubert and Dan Green. The X-Men race to confront Xavier, who is sitting in his wheelchair by himself. Thinking she may be wrong, it isn't until Jean Grey sees the Crimson Gem of Sidorak laying on his desk. She realizes what has happened, but it's too late. As Xavier transforms before their eyes into Onslaught, the X-Men realize how powerful he is as he attacks them psychically, and then leaves. Jean explains to the X-Men that Onslaught is indeed Xavier, who has apparently suffered an emotional psychic break, and all the resentment Xavier has for humanity has manifested itself as Onslaught, and has taken him over, burying the Xavier we know inside. Bishop realizes, at this time, that this may be the X-Traitor that he came from the future to stop. The X-Men regroup, and upon further investigation, learn that Xavier was reading files on Franklin Richards, and the recently reality-displaced Nate Grey, or X-Man, from the Age of Apocalypse. But they are then again attacked by Onslaught. Wolverine makes a comment about how the appearance of Onslaught resembles Magneto. As the X-Men are defeated by Onslaught, the Dark Beast asks to aid him, and they take Jean Grey prisoner. While she is believed to be incapacitated, Jean escapes to send out a video message begging for help to anyone that can hear it. The rest of the X-Men recover and attack Onslaught again, unleashing a full-on assault, seemingly knocking him out. But Bishop soon realizes it is a ruse, and just before Onslaught can unleash a psionic bolt, he dives in front of it, saving his teammates from the destiny of death, from the X-Traitor that has haunted him forever. Onslaught and Dark Beast leave the fallen X-Men to go focus on Onslaught's bigger plan. At the Fantastic Four headquarters, young Franklin Richards plays with a recent imaginary friend by the name of Charlie. And as this is going on, Nate Gray, X-Man, is appealing to Earth's mightiest heroes, the Avengers, to help him stop the oncoming threat of Onslaught. X-Men number 335, Onslaught Phase 1, From the Onslaught, An Apocalypse Comes. Writer, Scott Lobdell. Art, by Joe Madureira and Tim Townsend. Apocalypse rises and understands that a great battle is imminent, enough to warrant the appearance of the Watcher. The Avengers and X-Man show up at a nearly destroyed Xavier Institute and meet up with the X-Men. The two teams strategize on how to bring Onslaught down. Jean tells them that Magneto's persona was in Onslaught's mind as well, making Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver uneasy. The teams decide that Onslaught has targeted a few beings that possess immense power, and now they have sent teams to find Franklin Richards, Magneto, and Cable. Wolverine heads off on his own to try and help Xavier. On Muir Island, the group of Excalibur, consisting of Moira McTaggart, Nightcrawler, Colossus, Kitty Pryde, and Megan, receive Jean's message for help, and Moira says she may have to unseal the Xavier protocols. Avengers 401, Onslaught Phase 1, Sins of the Father. Writer Mark Waid, art Mike Diodato, and Tom Palmer. Gambit and the Avengers are off to find Magneto, while another team go to look in on Franklin Richards. Rogue and Magneto, now a de-aged amnesiac going by the name of Joseph, are living an innocent life across the country, and they are almost a couple. Rogue knows that Joseph is Magneto, but Joseph does not. In this issue, there is a focus on Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver overcoming the troubled past they have had with their father Magneto. And when they show up with the Avengers, they immediately attack a confused Joseph. Near the end of the battle, Wanda has to stop her brother from nearly killing Joseph, as she comes to understand Joseph has no recollection of his past as Magneto. Gambit can't believe Rogue is with Magneto, but has to concede she is her own woman. They all stop fighting, and Rogue and Joseph join the group to fly back and come up with a plan against Onslaught. Fantastic Four, number 415, Onslaught Phase 1, An Enemy Among Us. Writer Tom DeFalco, pencils Carlos Pacheco, inks by Bob Wiechek. Franklin and Charlie are off in an imaginary land straight out of Charlie's mind, and he tells Franklin not to tell his family anything. Onslaught shows up to snag Franklin just as the second team of Avengers show up. And in this issue, we have the Fantastic Four, we have Lijah, who is a Skrull girlfriend of Johnny Storm, Crystal, Hawkeye, and Bishop. All of the teams fight valiantly, however, Onslaught is too much, as he fells the heroes and leaves with Franklin. Cable, number 34, Onslaught, Phase 1, Loose Cannons. Writer, Jeff Loeb, art, Ian Churchill, and Scott Hanna. While Cable is recovering from a battle with Post, trying to keep the techno-organic virus that has ravaged his body at bay, and attempting to prepare for a battle with Onslaught, he now has to deal with a new threat, an Onslaught-controlled Incredible Hulk. In this issue, as the two battle, the Hulk actually goes from green to gray, and then finally, Aurora shows up to try and help, as Storm hits Hulk with a bolt of lightning. At the same moment, Cable hits him with a psychic assault. Our Gray Hulk turns into the Savage Hulk. And this Hulk is extremely powerful. The Incredible Hulk, number 444, Onslaught, Impact 1, Cablevision. Writer, Peter David. Artist, Angel Medina and Robin Riggs. The battle between Cable and Storm and the Hulk continue. Cable's able to go into the Hulk's mind to try and release him from Onslaught's grasp, and succeeds. Snapping back to reality, Storm and Cable use lightning to try and reboot Hulk's brain, nearly killing him. Hulk finally awakens to join the two and heads back to prepare for Onslaught. Does anybody have an explanation as to why Juggernaut in the first volume just appears out of nowhere?
Onslaught attacked him. I remember that. And that was the first issue back from Age of Apocalypse. A lot of that stuff, when Rogue kissed Gambit, when Wolverine popped a claw through Sabretooth's head, happened right as Age of Apocalypse happened. I mean, Rogue and Gambit thought the world was ending, so they were like, I may as well kiss. And then they fixed
it. Oh, that's right. I remember that.
Hey, Evan, I have a question for you, because another incident got referenced, and I don't know if it's in the Road to Onslaught Volume 3
okay.
or if it's in something that got referenced It's in the Wolverine solo comic, and they bring it up constantly.
Losing his adamantium?
No, that I knew about. But why he's wearing the do-rag.
Yeah, that was to hide his disappearing nose. What it was, I didn't read that issue, but if I remember right, everybody had the theory that in Wolverine 100, he would get his adamantium back. And so they had this setup like he was going to get his adamantium back. I think it had to do with Cable's son, Tyler, who was evil.
Oh, yeah.
And he didn't. And somehow the process that did or didn't happen made him more savage. So that's why he has no shoes and he's grunting and even hairier than usual and has a severe underbite all of a sudden. Okay. And yes, his nose is shrinking, it seems.
And the text, boy, they really get that across with the way that they are doing the lettering throughout the book. It's pretty insane. So go ahead, Mark. Did you have anything else there?
No, it's kind of the one point. Like with when you pick up the Road to Onslaught, Wolverine is just like living in a treehouse, and like he won't come in the mansion for two reasons. One, because he's like, well, if you guys are gonna let Sabretooth in there, then I'm gonna live out. I'm gonna live in the backyard. And Aurora's
you're living in a sweet treehouse.
He's like, Aurora's like, you're a grown man, and he's like, hey, bub, you know, he's not interested in being in the same house as Sabretooth. He shall not forgive nor forget.
He likes the actually, poop outside.
They actually did like a 4-issue limited series called Wolverine, the Complete Treehouse, where it shows him building and cutting down like each tree.
Wolverine Treehouse of Horror. I mean,
flashing back to each X-Men battle near the tree.
George Perez did the blueprint.
I believe what you're referencing is the trade paperback Wolverine's Rascals. Where the treehouse is no girls allowed.
It's like Garrison Kane and Maverick and all those guys climbing up in there. They say they're He-Man woman haters.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, no, that should be a thing.
If you came to this podcast for your first time, all right, ladies and gentlemen, misinformation abounds here, so don't go repeating anything you hear on this podcast to anybody who likes comics.
There's a guy on there right now going to Amazon going, Wolverine's Rascals, that sounds awesome.
Googling Wolverine Treehouse.
Maybe that's where Wolverine first met Squirrel Girl.
Oh,
there it is.
Could possibly be.
Insert squirrel noise here. The reason I bring that up real quick so we can just move this on. So there's a whole bit about him not wanting to come into the mansion while Sabretooth is there. So that much is actually true. But he also talks about he's in a place, and I don't know. Again, this happens outside of the trade in another comic, and they don't really tell you what happens. But the after effect is he's having a hard time controlling his aggression. So he's like, it's better. So it's like, even if Sabretooth wasn't there, he doesn't think he should be around the X-Men for very long because he doesn't know if he can control himself. And then, like, the next thing you know, as you said, he's more animalistic and has no nose, apparently. So I don't know what they're referencing, though, as to what made him a psycho and needing to live out in the wilderness.
Wolverine was not a title that I was picking up. Chris, do you have any
you're the only one in the 90s, then.
Chris, do you have any ad or whatever?
Funnily enough, and I've been a pretty consistent comic reader since about 89 or 90. All of the Road to Onslaught stuff pretty much took place in the brief period where I wasn't buying comics for about a year and a half, 2 years. Whenever I got back into it was right when the first Onslaught, like the first chapter of this trade was coming out. So I knew from Wizard that Onslaught was a thing that was going to happen. It was a pretty cool time to jump back into comics for me. But yeah, all the previous stuff, you know, I didn't really have much knowledge of that.
Okay. Well, Evan,
I basically went from Fatal Attractions to no more comics for a year and a half.
Scarlet Witch make you Onslaught.
Scarlet Witch said no more comics. was this the time when your mom and dad like said no more comics for you?
Right.
The one
she gave away like 95% of my comics.
And the M and L's of M stands for mom.
Mom. So, Evan, I want to switch it to you because one of the things that you mentioned, you know, we were talking about moments and topics we want to bring up. So this kind of segues into this particular topic. I mean, you mentioned how suspenseful the atmosphere was in X-Men 54 as we're getting to be, or you know, we're going to get this big reveal as to who Onslaught is. And now, were you picking up these issues as they were coming out off the shelves?
Yes, I was reading X X-Men, Uncanny X-Men, and X-Force, and I'd been grabbing some of the others. I mean, like I said, they started laying the groundwork for Onslaught as soon as they came back from Age of Apocalypse, so it had been building for a while. I grabbed some others here and there, like, I know, Chris, you mentioned Post. There was an issue where he showed up in Cable. I grabbed that to read what was going on. So yeah, I'd been following it. One of my favorites that just missed the cut in this trade was Uncanny 333, where they're trying to get intelligence on Operation Zero Tolerance, which would be the next big X-Men event after Onslaught. Gambit and Jean Grey are undercover deep in the heart of the Pentagon and are surrounded by all these people, and some mysterious stranger helps them escape, and it's Onslaught. And you just see this vague outline of his head, and he's talking to Jean Grey like, yeah, I helped you guys out. And she's like, okay, I'm not sure what to do with this. You know, we're not dead, but I don't think I trust this guy. And then that led into X-Men 53, where Jean's going shopping, and it has that whole thing with, you know, what people say versus what they're thinking. It reads a little, you know, we've seen this before, but when I was, I think I was 16 years old, I was like, oh, man, this is cool, because sometimes I think like a jerk, but act nice, you know? So those issues were awesome. Now, I don't know, and Jesse, you or Chris might have a better idea of this. I don't know how obvious it was in X-Men 53 and Uncanny 334 who Onslaught actually was, because I didn't know in X-Men 53, and in 334, I'm like, okay, yeah, there is something wrong with Professor X. You know what? I think he's Onslaught. So I called up a friend of mine, and I was like, you know what? I think Professor X is Onslaught. And he's like, yeah, it was in X-Men 54. It came out last week. You haven't read it yet?
Wow.
I was like, oh, yeah, no, I haven't. Thanks.
Good. But you got confirmation, though, so yeah.
But you know, looking back, of course, part of it may be because I know, but looking back, I'm like, was I the only person who didn't know at that point?
I was getting these off the shelf, if I remember right. And I mean, the 53 issue, you can kind of see what he looks like, but I was immediately going with Magneto. I was like, okay, this is, you know, he completely looks like some kind of warped, you know, hulked out version of Magneto. I didn't expect Charles Xavier at all. I had no clue that that's where we were going to end up in X-Men 54. So I was surprised. Chris, were you surprised, or did you know? Or you said it was from Wizard, so I didn't know if you got the news before.
Well, I mean, that Wizard had been, and Marvel and Wizard, or Marvel through Wizard, had been hyping up that Onslaught was the big event that was going to be happening during the summer, the crossover. So I was excited about it. And it was a mystery who Onslaught is. I don't remember what I was expecting or who I thought it was. I don't normally try and figure stuff like that out. I normally let the story reveal itself, unless it's really obvious, of course.
Sure.
Maybe I thought, you know, they're trying to make it look like Professor X is the Onslaught, so I'll bet it's somebody else. But I don't really remember what I thought going into it.
Okay. So
I was just going to say, even though I'm so spoiler phobic, and my friend inadvertently spoiled it, I mean, I was on the edge of my seat reading 54. Even though I knew what was happening, and going back and reading it, I mean, it wasn't exactly the same, but a lot of that atmosphere really holds up. I mean, that's a credit to Mark Waid wrote those particular issues, but I mean, Scott Lobdell had it going in Uncanny X-Men. When I got to go to my first big Comic Con, I got 53 and 54 signed by Mark Waid. I stopped him after a panel, and I was like, I just got to tell you, this comic was so awesome.
Yeah.
That was also the time my mom almost ran over him in the parking lot, but that's another story.
Chris, you know, we mentioned Age of Apocalypse a lot. Now, was that a dark period? Was that where you're not getting comics?
Yeah, I missed the boat. I've still never read the entirety of that.
Have you seen the movie? It's fucking amazing.
I agree with, I've seen it.
I agree with that. I've seen it.
But yeah, I've read I've got a couple of maybe three or four of the trades of the Amazing X-Men and Gambit and the Externals. And I've read the bookends of the Age of Apocalypse stuff, but I haven't read it in its entirety.
Yeah. So, Dark Beast is a thing throughout this, at least in the first few issues. And
is that his actual name? Because I got the impression that he was just an alien from another dimension who took on the guise of Beast in order to
He was actually Hank McCoy from a timeline where Professor X's son went back in time to kill Magneto, but he missed and killed his dad. And so it was a world where Xavier's dream lived on through the prism of Magneto, and Apocalypse took over everything. So this Hank McCoy was this just sadistic scientist, and there were like four characters from the Age of Apocalypse who survived when the timeline got fixed. And he was one of them. A Dark Beast is what they called him a lot. That's what his overpower card said. But a lot of times he just went by McCoy.
Because he's my favorite character so far in Onslaught. He's hilarious.
Did he dye his hair blue or fur blue?
I remember him being gray
in most of the issues.
Yeah, he was. That was in those issues referenced. I never had it, but I read it, you know, 20 some years ago. The one where he switched places with the Beast and like bricked him up behind a wall. We had just read The Cask of Amontillado in English.
No kidding.
So I don't know if it was an image inducer or, you know, some really heavy dye or some sort of genetic tinkering or whatever, but yeah, he was gray with like kind of long dark blue hair.
You said he's your favorite character, Mark.
He's hilarious. So like, first of all, one of the things about reading these comics is, I always read Beast in the voice of Kelsey Grammer.
Best thing about X-Men 3.
Yeah. That's also an amazing movie.
Misinformation, like I said, ladies and gentlemen.
Anyway, one of the most annoying things about reading this is just how wordy they make Hank McCoy, and I realize that's his character, and so I'm not going to complain about it too much, but it does kind of make me roll my eyes. And then, so you have this guy that's impersonating Beast, and he's not nearly as wordy or as intelligent, so he's got to, like, fake it. And so the characters are all like, Hank, are you okay? Like, what's wrong with you? And he's like, I'm fine. And then finally the Onslaught does, in fact, attack, and he's like, listen, I'm not really with these guys. Can I just serve you? Is that fine? I don't fuck these guys. That's what I say, right? Right? And also, it's like, I'm sure I have a use for you somewhere. And I'm like, that's perfect. Now I want to see this done as a movie. Just to see whatever slime ball they can get to play that version of Beast and him trying to ingratiate himself to Onslaught. It's hilarious to me.
And not to spoil anything, but just a heads up, his inability to be as verbose as the Beast does come up in a later story. It's actually kind of an important story point or moment. Yeah.
So far, he's like my big reason for wanting to continue with this story, other than we have it scheduled. I want to see what happens with him.
I guess it shouldn't be too unexpected that he's kind of, you know, as a bad guy from the Age of Apocalypse universe, he's kind of a coward as well.
Yeah.
And he takes one look at Onslaught and it's like, hey, this isn't going to go well for the X-Men. I'm just going to go ahead.
You seem emboldened with nope. So, you know what's funny reading these? The one thing I came away with all of the Road to Onslaught stuff and then the Onslaught proper, my favorite character is actually Cyclops. Who I never had any real love.
Nobody likes Cyclops.
I know.
But, I liked it back in the day.
But that's the thing. Like, I feel like he gets an unfair rap from the movies because, you know, not only like Fox favored Wolverine and Jean Grey and Professor Xavier over all the other characters, no matter how hard Halle Berry tried. So the poor guy that plays Cyclops, just, you know, they kill him in the first 5 minutes of X-Men 3. He has hardly anything to do in the first two movies. You just, if you've only seen the movies and then you go to read the comics, you just get the impression that Cyclops sucks. But reading these, I'm like, wow, he's actually a really cool, like, Captain America-ish character.
He's a leader.
Yeah,
he's always been a leader.
And a soldier and a badass. And I love the fact that that's the thing that also every villain cuts him down for. They're just like, you're just Professor Xavier is like errand boy. You're his lackey, you know? And he's like, no, he's just a straight up soldier, mm-hmm. You know? He's a soldier and a leader. You know, there's a really great moments with him and Jean as a couple, which you don't get to see in any of the movies. So it was fun to kind of see it in the comic. Like, oh, this is what they were doing in the comics that the movies couldn't get right to save their lives. The new ones with the new timeline after Days of Future Past, they still didn't really get it right. I thought they had a lot of time or, you know, scenes to work with. But my point being, I really enjoyed Cyclops throughout all of these issues. I thought that he was actually a really cool character. You know, somebody, you know, you could look up to. I thought he was a good model for. If you're, you know, 10, 11, 12, and you're reading these, he was like, oh, this is a character to point to and say, hey, I feel like this guy. He's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Chris, tell me about X-Man, or tell us all about X-Man. I mean, do you know much about X-Man and where he's from? He's going to be important. I know that much. Right. He's not really. We know that Onslaught is at least, or Xavier was reviewing files on Franklin Richards and X-Man. So X-Man's probably a dark spot for Mark. Kind of give us an idea who X-Man is.
Yeah, X-Man is another Age of Apocalypse holdover character. He was Cable. I believe that's right anyway. Evan may know better than me. But I believe he's basically the Age of Apocalypse Cable. He's still young, and he doesn't have the techno-organic virus that Cable is dealing with, so he's a lot more powerful. Because one of the reasons Cable, who is a telepath as well, but he's constantly keeping his disease in check with his telepathy or with the psionic powers.
Psionic?
Yeah, exactly. But he's basically right up there with Jean Grey as far as psionic and telepathy and telekinesis powers.
Yeah, he
doesn't have much play in this. In this volume, he shows up at the Avengers Mansion, basically saying Onslaught's coming. We're going to need to get to the X Mansion.
Yeah, he's the guy that kind of brings the rest of
the Avengers into the fold.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. X-Man was one of my favorite characters in the 90s. I thought I loved Cable because I was like, oh man, we got a time traveling superhero that happens to be the son of Jean and Scott that got sent into the future because of that techno-organic virus. And then X-Man shows up, which is, you know, Nate Gray, who has none of those inhibitions that Cable does. And it happens to be pretty much an alternate version of Cable that's just much more of a badass. And he's a young kid who's like cocky as shit, too. He's in this first volume, he's like, you know, I should be able to take care of him. I'm one of the most powerful beings in this world. And so, yeah, I was really excited to see him involved. Evan Bevins?
Yes.
Bishop, all right? Bishop and the X-Traitor. We kind of get a little bit of resolve here in the story. Why don't you tell us what happens and kind of give us your thoughts on it?
Okay, well, like somebody mentioned, this X-Traitor storyline had been around since Bishop first appeared. I think that was Uncanny X-Men number 287. And I was just looking up because I realized as much as I knew the X-Traitor was a thing, I didn't start collecting X-Men until about 6 or 7 months after that.
Oh, wow.
And so it was already it was always hanging over him, but I had to go back and look up the page where it's, like Chris was saying, Alex, Cable, John Boy.
That's a Walton's reference that I know.
But yeah, so that was always hanging over him. And what really makes this stand out, aside from the fact that it was just a cool storyline, I mean, it even made it into the X-Men cartoon. They combined it with Days of Future Past. But this was a rarity because it was a dangling X-Men plot thread that got resolved.
Yeah.
There were so many things in the 90s. The one that jumps out at me that they kept edging toward and teasing that they were going to reveal was the third Summers brother. You had Cyclops, you had Havoc, and there was one other. And, you know, Mr. Sinister was obsessed with the Summers DNA and the Gray DNA. And for a while, there was talk that it was Gambit. And then there was a super pure 90s character called Adam X, the Extreme. And there was an issue of X-Men that did everything but say he's the third Summers brother. And then everybody was like, really? It's Adam X? And then the calendar changed and the 90s were gone and Adam X disappeared. And years later, they revealed the third Summers brother in a story called Deadly Genesis that pretty much got me to swear off X-Men until Joss Whedon came to fix things.
I think I remember that story.
Unless that timeline's wrong and that happened after Joss Whedon. But anyway, I digress. The X-Traitor was a storyline that actually got paid off. And so Jean's message that opens Onslaught X-Men is the full message that it kept cutting out in 287 when Bishop was looking at it. So you get the full message. You can kind of tell that maybe that wasn't the plan all along. Like where it says mansion security was deactivated, and it's like, why would Professor X / Onslaught need to deactivate mansion security? So, I mean, that may not have been their plan going in, but they made it work. And like I said, getting any kind of payoff to those mysteries was a rare event back in the day.
Yeah.
As I loved X-Men.
I remember when we had Jordan on, one of the things that he mentioned was, and I this kind of keeps coming up, especially when we go back and we look at comics from, you know, the 90s or two decades past, is they would thread things in there and it would go on for years.
Oh, yeah.
And you do not really see that a whole lot. I mean, there may be an event that affects something for years, but it's not a setup for something that's going to pay off.
Well, no, on a book for more than 12 issues, it seems like.
I know, dude. Yeah. It's a rarity. So, yeah, to see the X-Trader storyline start that so far back and have, you know, be able to use elements of that as we go into the 96, the middle of 96, and pay this off, where now we know who the X-Trader is, and holy crap, it's the last person you'd expect. It's the guy that put the X-Men together. It's Professor Xavier. So that is probably one of the better strokes of this crossover, of this event.
But, well, before we move off of that, I just wanted to one of my favorite lines in that I'd forgotten about. But when I went back to read Onslaught X-Men, which I may not have read much, you know, after I initially did. But you know, the part where all the X-Men burst in to Professor X, and Jean's thinking, okay, I can't think about this. I can't let him know that I know. And they're trying to figure out what's going on. And Professor X says, "In many ways, I've never felt more awake. It is as if I have finally awoken from a dream." And, you know, I mean, the dream, Xavier's dream, is like the word so often associated with X-Men. And to see that turned around and him saying, "I'm done with it," is the only person that would be more shocking from would be Cyclops. And I didn't remember that jumping out the time before, but I'm like, man, that's just such a great turn of phrase to put so much weight, as wordy as the comics sometimes were, to put so much weight into that sentence just was,
yeah,
excellent.
Yeah, and to kind of put a bow on what I was saying there, you know, kind of bring this back to Bishop and the X-Trader thing. There's a point where, and I put this in my synopsis, where he has, Onslaught has the X-Men pretty much down. And he's got one more attack in him that he's going to level the X-Men with, potentially kill them. And the person that stands up and takes the brunt of that blast is Bishop. I think at that point in time, that is where it is all resolved. That's where, yeah, you know, he steps in front of that blast. This is the blast that would have killed them in his timeline, or did whatever, and he takes it.
Yeah, that's him erasing his future until 15 years later, some writers decided, hey, we need some more Bishop time travel hijinks.
When they got to the Fantastic Four, I actually really liked all the stuff with Franklin Richards, you know, where basically Onslaught is masquerading in Franklin's mind as a child, and he's trying to manipulate him. I thought all that was like really good stuff.
I can tell you that when I was first reading that, I didn't know if it was Xavier trying to make a play for help at first. But then, you know, when I think there's like a point where he smashes a glass of milk, and I'm like, oh man, something ain't right here. Oh, okay. And then we finally
Over the spilled milk, Jesse?
I did not cry over the spilled milk, okay. Sir. I was
clearly manipulating this child for nefarious purposes, malevolent purposes, you know, and boy, Jesse should know how this goes. Or if you've got young kids, it's just like, sometimes it's like, no matter how much you lead them, no matter how many breadcrumbs you put out there, they are so dumb. just to the point of fucking frustration where you're just like, I'm trying to, you know, like you just yell at them. Like, yeah, this is what I'm trying to do.
I've told you to do this three times the same way over and over and over. Yet this fourth time you've decided to do it completely against what trust me, I've been there.
Yeah, it's just like you try to be subtle with a kid and it's just impossible, and you just have to, you know, and that was what was happening, because Franklin's a dumbass. Like, he may be the best.
He's just a kid. Leave the kid alone.
Dumb child. I just loved that. I loved all of that. And then the other part about it, the other side of it, you know, the actual, like, give us the kid, we'll protect him from Onslaught. And the Fantastic Four are like, we all have superpowers and he's our kid. Fuck right off. Like, yeah, we're not giving you our kid. We can handle it.
Man, Reed Richards comes in with a force, doesn't he?
And then Reed Richards just, like, gasses up. Like,
yeah.
Reed Richards is looking, you know, look like fucking Batista. All of a sudden, it's like, I've never seen him use do that with his powers before. I'm not sure it really counts, by the way, when you have like inflated flexi muscles.
I did get into the physics in my mind when I read it. I was like, is he going to be able to hit him harder? I don't know. It's not like, real.
I muscle. Don't think,
at least.
I'm no, pretty no sure.
No offense, Jesse, but whose physics are you going to trust? Yours or Reed Richards?
Good point. Good point.
I don't think it works that way. I'm pretty sure if you're just made of rubber, but suddenly you make yourself look all yuked up, you don't suddenly get the power, the muscular power that you're imitating. I don't think it works that
well,
way.
Well, you know what? If we actually have any listeners on this podcast, I want to hear from you. What do you
yeah. If you've got flexi powers like that, if you've got stretch powers, can you please?
From experience.
Yeah, if you please. But it looked cool. You know, of all the, I joked offline about everybody in this book has like double F boobs. Is always crouching, has very poor posture, and you know, all, and everybody looks like Ivan Putski. Nobody knows that reference because I'm 100 years old. But he was an old wrestler who was jacked up.
I know Soda Popinski.
Hey, let me just say, in Reed Richards' defense, from that angle, when he's bursting in, and scale is not always you know, a concern in comics, who's sure. to say he's his regular height? He may have condensed himself, okay, sure. made himself more dense. He could be like 4'6" and wailing on Onslaught.
Be awesome.
I'll punch you in the knees.
Take his ankle out.
You think he's trying to look like the Hulk? He may be trying to be like Puck from Alpha Flight.
Oh, hey, shout out to Chris Bailey. He's always excited to hear Alpha Flight.
Let me tell you how the issues with the Hulk, he has like Sergeant Slaughter's or China's chin. This is some of the worst art I've ever seen in my life. I hated that.
We're going to talk about art because I'm swinging it to Chris Armstrong here in a few. But yeah, I almost thought Sam Keith was on that one issue because
I've never seen the Hulk drawn so badly.
You need to look.
Sam Keith draws a mean Hulk.
Yeah, Sam, I was going to say, I've seen Sam Keith Hulk before. It's like a pale imitation, what we got on there. I have the artist here in front of me. Yes, Angel Medina and Robin Riggs was on that issue. So Angel Medina, do you recognize that at all, Evan?
Yeah, I've seen, he's one of those artists that, like, I didn't recognize the name, but I kept finding stuff that I'd seen him draw. I think his style may have changed a little bit. Honestly, I think his Hulk, at least on the cover, looks kind of cool. It just doesn't look like the Hulk.
No, that face, no. Dude. The
looks
face
like fucking
looks like,
looks like Doomsday from Batman v Superman.
It just looks bad. I mean, it just, how about this? I'll put it this way. It just looks different. It's not what we're used to. You know, when we go from Ian Churchill's Hulk to Angel Medina's Hulk, it's completely different. Different.
And there's also some inconsistencies even from that Cable issue to the Hulk issue. I mean, it's supposed to be a direct continuation.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's kind of like, I think Jeff Loeb wrote the Cable issue. Peter David wrote the Hulk issue. They're two of my favorite writers. And we talked about all these stories they're weaving together. I mean, even in the Avengers and Fantastic Four issues, they didn't just go, forget everything that was happening in these books. They referenced other stuff, but there's just some disconnect between those issues because the way they beat the Hulk in the Hulk issue is the way they screwed everything up in the Cable issue.
I know. with the lightning bolt and the telepathic whatever. So, yeah, it's. I don't know why they went right back to that well, but they did.
And I think they just didn't communicate
or
very
they
well.
Both got the same script. But Mark, I stepped on you, and then we're going to go to Chris about art, even though we just probably ruined most of his points. But go ahead.
You can go ahead. I mean, I liked the idea of the Hulk stuff. The art was the shits.
Okay.
And I liked all the Fantastic Four stuff. I didn't have much of an opinion on the Avengers incorporation to the story, other than the Quicksilver, no matter what age you pick, the one consistency in the Marvel Universe is no matter when you pick up a book of Quicksilver's in, and he's going to be an intolerable dick.
Yes, sir.
But have you ever read X-Factor number 87?
No idea what you're talking about.
Okay, there's a very famous issue of X-Factor that Peter David wrote, and it explains why Quicksilver is such a jerk. Okay. Doc Sampson. Mark, I'm sure you know Doc Sampson from your
sure do.
Fandom. Yep. Okay. Forge was in charge of X Factor at the time, and he has Doc Sampson do therapy sessions with every member of the team. And when they get to Quicksilver, I won't spoil it for you, but you know, Doc Sampson, you know, basically asked him, why are you so hard to deal with? And there's just this great line that Peter David has where Quicksilver explains exactly why he's such a jerk. And you know, because I've always thought the same thing, and I still do, but you think back to that when you're like, okay, I understand a
it
little
makes
bit
sense.
Why. Yeah, so X Factor volume 1 number 87. It's a classic.
All right, well, Chris Armstrong, we had a bevy of artists, a bevy of storytellers throughout these 9 issues, I think. It was 8 or 9.
I couldn't really get a word in edgewise on the Fantastic Four discussion, but I want to make sure we acknowledge the cameo of Darkclaw that
yes.
takes place as Franklin and Onslaught are playing the Amalgam Overpower card game
nice.
While Reed Richards and Onslaught are battling it out.
Very 20 nice.
Years later, I'm still mad that we didn't actually get Amalgam Overpower.
A lot of really big artists on this, and some guys were just kind of starting to come up. The Kuberts, of course, were already a big deal at this time. Joe Madd was kind of becoming a big star, and I'm a huge fan of both the Kuberts and Joe Madd. Mike Diodato, he was kind of a journeyman almost, it seemed like, most of the 90s, but in the last 10 to 15 years, he's really become a bigger deal at Marvel. I can't defend Medina, whatever. I think it's really bad.
Funky cold Medina.
Yeah. Pacheco also becoming a big deal around this time. And Ian Churchill was, I'd never heard of him. I think this Hulk issue was probably the first issue I'd ever read, you know, that he had been
a part
of. But I became a big fan of his as he moved on out of Marvel. He was doing stuff for Awesome Entertainment in the late 90s.
Is he part of DC right now?
He was recently. I don't know if he is at the moment. But he's done some either Marvel or DC work in the last few years. But he kind of was out of the limelight for several years, it seemed like, until fairly recently I've seen him pop up some more. But yeah, a lot of really good art. And it makes for a kind of an uneven story as this art styles are pretty drastically different, especially when you go from the Kubert brothers to Joe Madd, who is a completely different style of artist, from Ian Churchill again to Medina, whatever. Yeah, it's a little jarring, but I also kind of, that's one of the things I kind of like about big crossovers, is seeing a variety of art styles that with one continuous story. I get kind of a kick out of it. Sometimes it doesn't work very well, but overall I'm a fan of it. As far as the writers, Wade and Lobdell, I guess, were the primary X-Men writers at the time. I think they probably had most of the say over how the direction the story went. The X-Men were the big deal at Marvel in the pretty much for the entire 90s. So that's not really a surprise. And this is, especially this first volume, is super X-Men and mutant heavy. It kind of expands as the story goes along into the other parts of the Marvel Universe. But this is really just an X-Men story at the beginning.
But at that point, I mean, you know, it's hard for some people to believe as big as the Avengers are. But, you know, with the Avengers in here, it was kind of like, oh, isn't that nice? The X-Men are throwing the Avengers a bone, letting them get. I mean, the Avengers was really uneven at that point. And, you know, after what happens next, maybe we won't spoil it, but they kind of got course corrected when Kurt Busiek came in years later.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get into it more as the story progresses. But part of the design of this storyline is to usher the classic Marvel heroes, Fantastic Four and Avengers, into a relaunch to kind of reinvigorate those franchises, which had kind of stalled out, but
which was being heavily advertised in the issues where the story was unfolding.
was it already pretty obvious that they were going to be doing an alternate universe type deal?
I was trying to remember that, because I mean, like, I'm looking in that the issue of Avengers that was in this. I had all of these issues that I pulled out of the old long boxes, and like on the letters page for Avengers 401, it's like, hey subscribers, after next issue we're going on a 2-month hiatus, but then it'll be back. And there were, like, on the back page of these comics, it was like, hey, here's a special deal so you can could subscribe to Heroes Reborn.
And, wait a second.
Yeah, I don't think we knew how it was going to happen, but we already knew that Jim Lee and Rob Liefeld were being given the keys to these characters. I don't think we knew exactly how it would happen.
Yeah, I'm wondering if that final issue with the resolution of the story, if that's when it kind of became clear what was going to happen. Because I don't really remember knowing ahead of time. Maybe it was obvious, but I don't really remember.
I know something was going on, and I know that when they got to the end of the story, which, you know, obviously we'll save for a future podcast, but I was surprised.
I want to stop real quick and ask Mark. Mark, do you have any idea where this is going to lead? You haven't read ahead, have you?
I have not.
Okay. Do you have any idea where this is going to lead?
I mean, this is the 90s. This is the 90s. The only like hard reset that I'm aware of is Secret Wars, which, by the way, yeah, if you don't explain to certain people who don't read comics what the pizza pies are, they get very confused when you bring it up. As I found out doing a podcast with Alexis Haina and Ronnie Adams last night.
Yeah, so yeah, there's a pretty big deal that happens after this. Chris, you mentioned seeing some old events as a snapshot of that era throughout the books. One thing, the Teen Iron Man. I don't think you have that written down here.
All right.
Can somebody explain Teen Iron Man to me?
That's what we'd all like to know.
Do
you want to take this one, Chris?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so, I will confess that I have not read this.
Okay.
But Avengers The Crossing has been called on occasion the worst Avengers story ever.
Okay.
From what I understood about
it. That's an achievement.
Yeah. From what I understand, the way I always read it is it was them trying to X-Men-ify the Avengers. There was time travel. There was a lot of personal stuff. I mean, the Avengers had friends, but the Avengers was always like, you know, kind of like a business. Mm-hmm. Part of the revelation was that Kang had been messing with the Avengers throughout time, including basically turning Iron Man into his personal assassin.
Okay.
So Iron Man was, you know, total bad guy. At some point, the Avengers figured, well, the best thing to do is go back in time and get a teenage Tony Stark, who's probably from an alternate timeline, to replace him. I didn't read that. I didn't understand it. They had kind of written themselves into a corner with that, that Heroes Reborn does and does not address. But, basically Iron Man had been a double agent for Kang for much of his history, supposedly, so they went back and got a teenage Tony Stark to replace him. And the only real hint we get of that in Avengers 401 is when he's so impressed with his repairs that he forgets to open the door for the Quinjet to come out.
These big company-wide crossovers are always kind of cool as a snapshot of what was going on across the Marvel Universe at that time. Because I don't even know how this happened, but I see Wasp is like a mutated insect lady at this point. Nathaniel Richards, Reed Richards' dad, is part of the FF.
Yeah, who gives Onslaught, well, I wouldn't say gives Onslaught an arm for his money, but he definitely
is pretty powerful.
Yeah,
he does more than most people.
Exactly. Yeah.
The Savage Wolverine stuff, which we had talked about earlier, that was the version of Wolverine at this time. So it's always cool to see, like, you can kind of remember what was going on in each of these characters' lives at this time if you're looking back on it. Like, as far as, like, DC, when you go back and read, say, the Justice League run that Grant Morrison was working on, there are some issues where Superman is Blue Superman in those issues. And it's like, well, if he was the real Superman, he would probably be able to deal with this threat pretty easily. But it's happening at a time where he only has these electric powers and whatnot. I get a kick out of seeing that kind of stuff when I go back and read these big crossovers.
Mark, was there a point in this book where you were just like, okay, who the hell is this? Or what is this person doing? Why is this person looking like this? Anything from the 90s confuse you as he was going through it?
Just what we already talked about with Wolverine, because it's not in the trades that I read. I know Jean Grey refers to herself as Phoenix, so I'm guessing this is sometime after, like, the Dark Phoenix saga was, I think, what, back in the 80s, Jesse?
Yeah, that was the 80s. Mm-hmm.
So I guess somewhere along the line, she came back, but still referring to herself as Phoenix, but obviously not nuts.
Yeah, there was a reference at some point, you know, she and Cyclops had a daughter in an alternate timeline who became a member of the X-Men in the regular timeline, as you do, and she went by Phoenix, and there was there was some story where she had contact with her again, and she asked her to use the Phoenix name again, like as a legacy, even though she wasn't actually Phoenix at that point.
I remember also there was a, and I'm pretty sure it came before this, there was a, I think a 4-issue mini of Adventures of Cyclops and Phoenix, where they go into the future to raise Cable.
Right. And
I don't, at that point, obviously she was either using that name, I would assume.
Yeah, they actually referenced that.
Okay. So we'll just go around the horn here. Burning Desires or stuff I left out. So we'll start with Evan Bevins. Was there anything else moment-wise throughout this series that you wanted to bring up?
I covered the high points. I said when we were talking before this, it made sense from a story perspective for Gambit to be the guy they sent to the Avengers so he could run into Rogue. But I just can't imagine Cyclops going, you know who we should send out to the Avengers? The thief that none of us trust. Yeah, let's do that.
I think in a perverse way, it does make sense, though. Who don't we want around? Oh, the guy that's probably going to betray us. Here, Captain America, take him.
There you go. There's actually years later a point where Rogue joined the Avengers, and she and Gambit are talking, and she's like, you know, you can come join the Avengers with me. And Gambit's like, yeah, I don't think that's going to happen.
But you could tell there's still that chemistry between the two. And it's just probably because of the history I'm used to reading.
And it's not only that, but, you know, Rogue and Magneto had a thing.
That's right.
About 70 issues ago. Mm-hmm. Magneto's powers, because magnetism, means he can actually touch Rogue.
Oh, okay. I don't remember that. Okay. You said it was 70 issues prior to this?
Yeah. I remember one of the first X-Men comics I got was way back in X-Men 275. They had a little liaison in the Savage Land. And then in Age of Apocalypse, they were actually married.
That's right.
And they had a child.
Did they ever tell you what his big secret was that was driving Rogue crazy?
Oh, yeah. Do you want to know?
Yes.
Okay. Have you ever heard of the Mutant Massacre?
Vaguely.
Okay. That was when Sabretooth and the Marauders went in and slaughtered the Morlocks. The Morlocks were the ugly mutants that can't pass for human and lived in the sewers. Okay. So the Marauders went in and slaughtered them. I don't know if it was said then or later that Mr. Sinister had them do it. And this is one of those long-running X-Men plot lines that was kind of a letdown. Gambit's the one that led them into the tunnels.
So he's responsible for a ton of mutants being murdered.
Right, except Gambit hadn't been created back then, and pretty sure they just had to open a manhole. But
Jesus Christ, so this is like Original Sin with Iron Man, where he's somehow responsible for the accident that turned Banner into the Hulk, except that he's not and he wasn't there?
Yeah, I mean, Gambit, he was working for Sinister, and he basically led the charge. I think there was supposed to be some, it's been a while since I read it, but there was supposed to be something that only Gambit's thief skills could get them in, some gate or something like that. Yeah, so that came to a head in, I think it was Uncanny 350. They had kissed, and with Gambit influencing her mind, Rogue convinced the X-Men to leave him in the middle of Antarctica, not the Savage Land part.
Oh, geez.
But he came back.
Talk about your cold shoulder.
Aha!
Thank you very much. Here all night, ladies and gentlemen. Please bring your kids.
Try the beat.
All right. Any other big moments there, Evan?
It was awesome to go back and I'm sure I reread this some right after it came out, but it was cool to get to go back, and I was a little nervous, like, oh man, what if it doesn't hold up? And I mean, there's some stylistic stuff that maybe dates it a little, but I mean, it held up to me. I had as much fun reading it this time as I did when it was coming out. And this time I had at least a vague idea what order it was supposed to be in, because Impact 1 and Phase 1.
Yeah, you said you were going to look into those. Did you have any idea why?
And I did that almost 5 minutes before you started recording. but basically, Phase is the main part of it, like the main machinations of Onslaught, and Impact is how it impacts the wider Marvel universe, the stuff that that is related to it but not part of the core story, which I thought it was funny. Even I was pulling out all my Onslaught issues and then looking at the trades to find out what order they're in. There's two issues of Generation X that are labeled Impact that aren't in any of the trades. And I also found an issue of X-Men Unlimited in a dollar bin that deals with what happened to Juggernaut after Professor X wipes the floor with him in this volume.
Oh, nice.
That I never read before and that isn't in any of the trades.
Okay.
So,
okay. Yeah, we'll definitely touch on that. Mark, this villain, Onslaught, what do you think of him?
I mean, It's, I like the idea that Xavier sort of evolves from what he is into this entity that's so full, you know, that is the end result of his restraint and frustration and disappointment and failures. That, you know, this isn't just a monster of the week. I mean, I'm someone jump in and be like, no, you misunderstood if I'm not getting this, but this feels like, in his own way, Xavier, it kind of reminds me of what they allude, it kind of reminds me of the Old Man Logan story where Mysterio gets into Wolverine's head and he thinks he's being, you know, the mansion's being attacked, and he just fucking slaughters the X-Men. And then he's like, I'm nuts and full of guilt and I need to go now. And he, yeah. until the world kind of collapses and he's forced to, you know, he doesn't become violent again. You know, this is kind of that story for Xavier where it's just like, I want mutants and humans to live together and nothing's going his way. Things are just getting worse. Mm-hmm. And again, that's why I love the Cannonball thing. He's like, you know, Legacy Virus and Dead X-Men and just one horror after the other, and in walks Cannonball. I don't think I'm a good member of the team. You're fucking not, all right, asshole?
Take a walk.
Why don't you cannonball into the fucking yard? Go find Wolverine.
Go find a tree to sit in.
You know, it's
hey,
like,
Logan, can I build a treehouse too?
I love the idea that instead of it being like a Mr. Sinister or Apocalypse or Dr. Doom or anything, it's Xavier Plum lost his mind for a good reason. Mm-hmm. You know, he's just at the end of his rope, and they can kind of tie like, oh, well, this is the result of the mind wipe. But to me, it's a stronger story where he just fucking snapped after a while.
We get the sense, or I do at least. Do you get the sense that Onslaught is completely a separate entity from Xavier? Because I think there's a panel or maybe even a page where it just shows like Xavier's in a fetal position on the inside of Onslaught's mind. So I think that they're two separate things. It's just like this.
The story works better for me if Onslaught is to Xavier what Savage Hulk or whatever the personality of the Hulk that's like supposed to be his dad is to Banner, or even just what the Hulk is to Banner. Just this rage that, you know, this untempered rage that's residing inside you that, you know, you kind of keep in a box. And, you know, it's so funny because, like, I'm gonna make a reference here, and it might be a little unwieldy, but bear with me. There's an Australian comic named Jim Jefferies who did a very, very, very famous bit that none of you guys have ever heard of, because that's how this goes, right?
Was it on a radio program?
Sorry. He did a bit about gun control, which has been shared all over the place. It's been on the news, you know, that this one little bit that he did in a comedy and stand-up show years ago. He talked about how, you know, one of the things he talked about in the gun control bit is, you know, people was like, well, I would never go crazy and shoot people. He was like, you don't know that, you know, and then he's as he says, it's not a TED talk. He's making jokes. But what he's saying is you don't know what you're going to do with a gun once you have one, because every once in a while we all get sad, you know, and I really do buy into the concept of, you know, like the Book of Job and, you know, the whole like one bad day where, you know, we're all civilized, decent, God-fearing, good to our mothers, apple pie eating human beings, then strip everything we love and hold on to from us. What are you capable of then? That's actually something we've tackled before, Jesse, because I can almost to the word remember I've said that on this podcast or one of the TV parties or whatever. Just this idea of when you strip a human being bare, are they still going to cling to their, you know, their moral compass? Or will you see them for, you know, the crazy nuts that you know, that people are, that or potentially can be? I buy into the story and kind of accept the idea of Xavier being Onslaught if it's more that than anything else. It's just he's always had, to one degree or another, an Onslaught inside of him potentially, but he's had this, you know, he's had this life around him and it's been stripped bare.
Yeah.
And all
yeah.
that's left now is Onslaught.
Yeah.
By the way, this makes me frustrated that Fox fucked the X-Men franchise up and then sold their movie studio, because I would have loved to have them to have attempted this.
Oh, yeah.
and messed it up too. But
now they dude, still did a couple more shots at Dark Phoenix.
The ultimate, I think, me personally, when I was reading this, I always thought to myself, this was the great swerve. This was, you know, all this history of the X-Men coming up to this point, and the great betrayer, not just in Bishop's timeline, but in our timeline, the great betrayer of the X-Men is going to be the person that brought them together. I'm sure there may have been a couple comics beforehand that dealt with maybe Xavier turning on the X-Men in some weird capacity, but there was nothing like this. I mean, I haven't read all the X-Men comics, but I would imagine there was nothing like this. And this would have been great to see on film. Yeah. Imagine them building an X-Men universe, much like they did with Marvel Cinematic, to where the big bad was going to be Onslaught. I mean, that would have been a great set of films. But all right, go ahead, continue, Mark.
That was just it. You know, I would have loved to have seen, and maybe we'll get it with Marvel now, but this saga screams, like, you know, big event picture.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So you mentioned Onslaught. Hey, we mentioned Onslaught at some point in this comic podcast about Onslaught. You mentioned Apocalypse, and Chris, one of your notes were kind of about the sprinkling of Apocalypse throughout this book. Did you have anything else you'd like to add about some of the stuff we see with Apocalypse in it?
I don't really have a whole lot. I would just happy to see him. I guess this is probably his first appearance since the Age of Apocalypse storyline, and this is a different version of Apocalypse anyway. I'm not sure what the last appearance in the MCU proper was before this, but it was cool to see him kind of lurking in the background. Both Apocalypse and Mr. Sinister have a part to play in the future of the story. They don't do a whole lot. I don't think Mr. Sinister doesn't even appear, I don't think, in this volume. But Apocalypse is here hanging out with Uatu a couple times.
Yeah, the Watcher, buddy.
So he's kind of lurking in the background, and he'll have more to do, I think, in the next volume. But it's always cool to see Apocalypse. I love the Apocalypse character design. So it's cool seeing Joe Madd take a stab at it. I think he also appears in the Cable issue. Cable and Apocalypse are like this, you know, the sworn. Cable is, you know, the sworn enemy of Apocalypse. So that's going to come to a head, I'm sure, at some point.
Got to. I mean, obviously, just like you said, Apocalypse doesn't do a whole lot here. But you know, they wouldn't be mentioning him. It would suck if they just mentioned him and he wasn't like something later on down the road in the next three volumes. Chris, Burning Desires. Anything left unsaid that you wanted to say about this first volume? In our Onslaught discussion.
The only other thing I think I was going to mention was the scene in, I guess it was X-Men 64 or 54, maybe? The issue, anyway, the preceding X-Men Onslaught issue, Xavier is revealed as Onslaught, and, you know, Juggernaut has approached Jean Grey trying to get her to, like, he's like, I know who Onslaught is, but, you know, I can't remember. I need you to find this out for me.
Mm-hmm.
And, eventually she realizes, like, it's too late, you got to get out, and he's trying to escape, and then he ends up being confronted by Onslaught, and the scene where Onslaught just rips the, what's that called, the Crimson Gem
of Sidorak.
Yep. Yeah, he just slices his chest open and pulls the gem out.
Juggernaut is not a lightweight. He is not a lightweight.
Right, exactly.
He's huge.
And he's already, you know, demolished Juggernaut once in the past.
Yes.
But this time it's particularly brutal. And I am kind of curious how exactly Professor X is quite this powerful. Because he's basically just a telepath, right?
I don't
know. Combination of psionics and magnetism.
Well, that,
which,
yeah,
which means nothing. I'm that's sorry.
I mean, you can always find a reason why it works, I guess. But yeah. It, at this point, it's supposed to be just, we're supposed to think anyway, that it's just Xavier.
There's a hint that he looks like Magneto, and we don't know why.
Yeah.
We don't know why. I mean, because Wolverine just about says it, and he gets smacked before he finishes the sentence.
Yeah, there's some interesting behind-the-scenes stuff with Onslaught's origins that we can bring up in the next pod, because I think a lot of that stuff gets revealed in the next volume, story-wise. And there's some interesting stuff with Mark Waid in behind-the-scenes with that stuff.
You know, round the horn here. I mean, your experience going back and reading it there, Evan, you have a good time?
Oh, absolutely. I thoroughly enjoyed it. You know, what worked still worked. And, you know, the stuff that you lose after reading it the first time, you know, the nostalgia and other stuff that I see going through, you know, replaces that. So, yeah, looking forward to the rest of it.
Okay, Chris? You enjoy yourself?
Yeah, for sure. Like Evan said earlier, you know, I read this when it came out. Not every issue. I was, you know, a teenager, didn't have a lot of money. But I picked up a big chunk of the Onslaught stuff. And once I had a hefty collection, you know, and the majority of the issues, I went back and reread it a few times in the next couple years after it came out. But it's been a good 20 years probably since I've read this. So it was cool to go back and give it another read.
Okay, very
good. I think
good.
It holds up pretty well.
Yeah, I really kind of picked on the storytelling just in those couple issues between Cable, but I didn't find any very inconsistent stuff. You know, the storyline as a whole in this first volume was told pretty decently, where there wasn't a whole lot of head scratching moments where it's like, okay, well, wait a second, what about this or what about that? But I had a decent time going through it, revisiting. I think I own at least, I would say 90% of this first volume. So I know I was picking it up as the issues were being released. Mark Radlich, this was your first time going through Onslaught. Do you have a good time?
Yeah, I'm really enjoying it. I'm looking forward to seeing what happens next. And, you know, how do you defeat somebody like Professor Xavier, who's this powerful and gone this crazy?
Yeah. All right. All right. Well, then, till volume two, this, which will be, I think, dropping next week. Yep, it'll be dropping next week. We'll be recording next week. This will be the second trade paperback, and I don't know what in the world's going to be included in on this next one. I'm sure it's going to be another 8 or 9 issues. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think this brings our discussion of complete Onslaught Epic trade paperback volume one is what we're looking at here. We're coming back volume two next week, and all September we're going to finish this sucker out, so we're going to have a good old time. So let's get into plugs here.
This mother out.
All right, Evan Bevins, tell me, do you have some articles? I know you got a comic book, or at least an online comic that people can look at. I don't know if it's all the way done yet or not, but you got any articles to share? Tell us, give us some plugs.
Okay, well, support group, the web comic about a support group for people with lame superpowers, in case your origin doesn't turn out the way they showed in the comics. That's on Webtoons. We're getting back up in the habit of posting regularly. Coming up in the September issue of Graffiti, West Virginia Entertainment Magazine, we'll have a look at missing Marvel characters, which are all the times Marvel introduced licensed characters into their continuity and then lost the licenses. So Godzilla, Rom Space Knight.
Nice.
I have 4 volumes of Essential Marvel 2-in-1, which lasted 100 issues, but only 98 issues because Marvel can't reprint The Thing and Doc Savage and The Thing and Rom. So we'll reveal the connection between Doctor Who and the Marvel Universe.
Ooh, interesting. Yeah.
That's a tease. I'll tell you about it after we're off recording, Jesse.
All right.
In the Parkersburg News and Sentinel, to mark the occasion of Godzilla King of the Monsters coming out on DVD, I'm going to write about various and sundry other giant monsters to populate comics. Everybody from Groot and Jesse's favorite Tim Bubba to Starro the Conqueror.
Ooh, very nice. Well, Chris Armstrong, my 90s comics buddy there from the Unspoken Decade and Unspoken Issues. What do you have to plug, sir?
Not a whole lot, but you can follow me on Twitter at BrodyMan34, and you can check out Unspoken Issues, the 90s comic podcast from theunspokendecade.com. Also check out theunspokendecade.com, a 90s comics fan site. Jesse and I both have some stuff up on there, as well as some stuff from Dean Compton and a few other folks. It's pretty cool if you're into 90s comics. It's a great resource.
Yeah. Upcoming Unspoken Issues podcast, we are going to be discussing Supreme number 42. And I think it was a landslide victory.
It was.
Landslide.
Spider-Man, Batman.
That's right. Spider-Man, Batman. Expect that to be, well, we got to record that first, and then we'll be putting that up here. And then we have a third poll that I should be putting together here pretty soon. So if you are a fan of theunspokendecade.com, if you're a fan of 90s comics, hop onto that Facebook page and watch for the poll to show up, Ed, because we want to hear from you what you would want us to cover. There's going to be 2 choices there. You pick one of them, and we will podcast about it. All right, Mark Radlich, what do we got coming up on the schedule?
All right, so tomorrow on the Radlich and Broadcasting Network, We've got a TV party for Hannibal season 3, the last season of Hannibal. We're finally done with this. We do it every fall, usually closer to Halloween, but there was no room on the schedule this year. So we're doing it tomorrow. We'll also have a TV party for New Japan Pro Wrestling, London Quest, NXT UK Cardiff, and AEW All Out. So that'll be fun. On Wednesday, you're going to get another source material because I will actually be at Knotfest. So there'll be no Metal Hammer of Doom. If you don't know what Knotfest is, that's Slipknot's concert. They're being supported by Gojira.
Boy Scouts of America.
Yes. That one DC character. they're being, I believe it's Gojira, Behemoth, and Volbeat will all be there along with Slipknot. So in the meantime, you'll be getting the second volume of X-Men Legacy Volume 2, Invasive Exotics. And the reason why we're tackling that is because we will be reviewing the last season of Legion, Season 3, on Thursday, September 5th. There's nothing the 6th. I actually have a rare day off from podcasting. But during the day on September 7th, Khabib Nurmagomedov will be defending his lightweight title against Dustin Poirier. It worked pretty well the first time, so Robert Winfrey is going to join me again for split coverage. He'll be doing his written coverage for 401 Mania, and he'll be doing live commentary with me as we watch the main card of UFC 242.
We do have a Patreon, so if you are interested in some of that ever so exclusive content that the Rattlechin Broadcasting Network has, then you should go check it out. There's all sorts.
We have our first exclusive show, a show that's never been released before, finally. You can't get it anywhere but on our Patreon. So if you spend a buck, you can hear us talk all about D23.
Yeah, it's set up for custom. So if you feel like dropping $20 a month just because you enjoy us that much, then feel free, because all you have to do is type in the amount you want to donate per month, and Patreon does all the rest of the work for you. It gives you those links so you can get in there and check out those exclusives, and more content to be coming. Trust me, it's on its way. So other than that, Mark Rattlich talks about PodCoin an awful lot. Let me tell you, if you want to get paid to listen to us, I mean, look, there might be a way for you to offset it. You can get paid listening to PodCoin, somehow use that money, go get you a coffee, and that money you spent for the coffee, you could put towards the Patreon, all right? What do you think of that, Mark?
Oh, Jesse, you're my hero.
Yeah, there you go. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. There's some math for you. So, yeah, you could check that out. PodCoin, you can get paid to listen to podcasts. Spectacular app. We definitely stand behind it. And we are featured on there. Mark, is that right? Is that something that happened here recently? You featured a podcast on there? What was that all about?
Yeah, we're the hot podcast right now. If you hit Discover on the PodCoin app, ours comes up with a bunch of other ones. We'll be renewing that soon, so we'll be a little more visible. We're really pushing the PodCoin, and we're pushing the Patreon, because as Clutch likes to remind us, we need some money.
That's right. Money, money, money. All right. Can plugs going in here at the end. Chris Armstrong's joined me. Evan Bevins. Almost forgot Evan Bevins' name. Ridiculous.
What?
I'm a horrible host. I'm like, yeah. Mark Rattlich, Evan Bevins, Chris Armstrong. I'm Jesse Starcher. We will check you out next week. Onslaught continues. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Thank you all for joining us. Make sure to give that Rattlich in Broadcasting Facebook page a like to stay up on top of all the great podcasts we have to offer. We are at home on Spreaker, but you can also find us on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and recently we have hit the air on Spotify. Find your favorite podcast platform and type in RADULICH to subscribe for some great content. If you enjoyed this show, please feel free to share and spread the word. And as always, we appreciate any feedback and look forward to entertaining you again soon.
All right, so let me tell you the story of how I almost punched my son dead in the nose and broke his glasses.
It is going to be a long 14, 15 years for you, sir.
And now I know why my father beat me over home park.
At least you didn't repress that and become a giant psychic armor monster.
You read The Road to Onslaught, right?
Two out of three volumes, yes.
Oh, okay.
Not going to be a loaf. That ain't bad.
You guys sent me your moments, didn't you?
I think marks were boobies and muscles.
Yep.
Why'd you have to make a record about me? The R-O-X-A-N-N-E. My goodness.
Oh, gosh. What was the gal's name? It wasn't Schooly B. That was a dude.
Ice cream tea?
Yeah, that's the one.
Julie Andrews?
Yes. Julie Andrews used to rock the fucking mic, dude.
Here, welcome, everybody. What episode is this?
Be like Marvel and start it all over at number one.
Oh, that'd be spectacular.
Then you go back to legacy numbering for anniversary issues.
Okay. Onslaught's a very popular name. My next child, his first name will definitely be Onslaught. Onslaught Rattledge.
Did I just ruin this for Mark?
No, don't worry. I'm sure he could give a shit less. Trust me. He's the guy that's on Wikipedia looking up endings for movies that ain't even come out yet.
You're a monster.
Jesse, are you referencing the time I ruined Age of Ultron for myself because I couldn't wait to see the
yes.
movie?
Yeah.
You know who's really into metal?
Tell me.
Magneto.
On that note...
With Dunkin' Go-To's, you can get a great deal on two of your favorites, like two egg and cheese wraps for $2, two bagels with cream cheese spread for $4, and two bacon, egg, and cheese croissants for $5. In my opinion, it's a deal that's pretty tough to beat. That's just if you want my go-to cents. If you don't want my go-to cents, it's go-too late. Dunkin' Go-To's, a great deal for $2, $4, or $5. America runs on Dunkin'. Participation may vary. Limited time offer. Exclusions apply.
How do you escape an unstoppable evil when that evil is you? Step inside Jordan Peele's new original nightmare as Us comes to life at Universal's Halloween Horror Nights. Select nights September 6th through November 2nd. Experience Netflix's all-new Stranger Things, Dracula and the Wolfman, and more. Save up to $52 on select nights. Visit HalloweenHorrorNights.com. Online only. Restrictions apply. Not recommended for children under 13.